we need to see what exactly is error correction. Just a quick look at classical error correction, and then we will see what is quantum error correction, and then just go to the main result. That's the hardness of correcting errors on a quantum code. Okay, computational complexity. Problems in computer science are classified based on how long they take to be solved on a computer. Some problems are easy, which means we can solve them efficiently. For example, arithmetic operations, matrix multiplications, and so on. These problems are classified in the class P. And what we mean by efficient is that the time that it takes to solve these problems is polynomial in the size of the input to the problem. Now, of course, we don't have such efficient solutions for all problems, but some problems are such that even though we don't have an efficient solution, we can always verify a proposal for a solution in polynomial time. These problems are classified in the class NP. So these are all problems such that any certificate can be verified in polynomial time. Well, some problems are harder than some others, which means we need more effort to solve these hard problems. In the sense that if we can solve this hard problem, we can solve many problems which are easier than this problem. So in the class NP, you have some problems where if you can solve that problem, you can take a solution to that problem and use it as a subroutine to write an efficient algorithm for any problem in NP. These problems are called NP complete. So these are all problems whose solution can be used to solve any other NP problem in polynomial time. Well, sometimes we just don't want one solution. We want to know how many solutions are there to a given problem. And problems which count how many solutions are there to an NP problem are classified in the class that's written as hash P, and it's read as sharp P. Okay, just like NP complete, there are some problems in sharp P which are really hard, which means if we have a solution to those sharp, to those particular set of problems, you can count solutions to any NP problem, which may, and these problems are classified in sharp P complete. Now, these are all really abstract classifications in computer science as far as someone from physics is concerned. So let's just see if these terminologies are used by a physicist. Okay, hard problems in physics. Now, everyone at some point has seen this model of spins on a lattice with nearest neighbor interactions. Now, we want to ask that given this Hamiltonian for this model, what's the ground state of the system? Now, everyone knows that the ground state is this, or all spins pointing downwards. In other words, these problems can be solved exactly on a computer, and this is what we call problems in P. Now let's introduce local magnetic fields in this model. So a red is a field that points outwards and a green points inwards. Now we ask a similar question. Is there a configuration of spins on the sides such that the total energy is less than E? Now, of course, there are exponentially many configurations for you to try each one and see if the energy is less than E. So you have a problem where you don't have a polynomial time solution. But if I tell you that this is the configuration, you can just quickly verify it with the Hamiltonian, whether its energy is in fact less than E or not. So this problem doesn't have a polynomial time solution, but you can always verify a claim in polynomial time. And these problems such as this are in NP. In fact, it turns out that this problem is really hard, which means if you can solve this problem, you can use this algorithm as a subroutine to solve any NP problem. This problem is also NP complete. So because of this, it's strongly believed that NP complete problems cannot have efficient, that's polynomial time solutions. Now just consider an extension of this. Instead of wanting to know whether there's a configuration, you just want to find the partition function of this model. Now, the partition function is in some sense related to counting how many states are there of a given energy. Now, you see that to find if a state is exists with an energy less than E, it's NP. So if you want to count solutions to this NP problem, it's a problem in sharp P. In fact, it turns out that counting, computing this partition function is really hard, which means if you can do this, you can solve many more hopelessly hard problems in computer science that involve counting solutions to NP problems. And this problem is sharp P complete. So we more very strongly believe that sharp P complete problems do not have polynomial time solutions. Okay, so the take home message is easy problems, we call them P, hard ones, we call them NP complete, and really, really hard ones, we call them sharp P complete. Okay, now we want to see what this has to do with error correction. What is classical error correction? In classical information is encoded and transmitted in bits, which are strings of ones and zeros. Okay, suppose you want to transmit two alphabets, A or B, and you fix a convention that A is 000 and B is 111. Now, suppose the receiver hears 001. Now, definitely something happened during transmission, which means some bits got flipped. And you want to know which bit got flipped. Any guess? So most likely 000 was sent, which means the last bit got flipped. Or you could say that 111 was sent and the first two bits got flipped. But you see, if I say that the probability of bit flip on each wire is P, then the probability of the vector 001 adding to the transmitted sequence is P, whereas in the latter case, it's P square. And since these are probabilities, P is much bigger than P square. So you should just go and flip the last bit to get the correct sequence. Now, all this is good, but we can do better. We know that A and B stand for these two bit strings, but we needn't really remember these two sequences. We can just store some key properties that these sequences have so that instead of storing long binary sequences, you can just store these properties. And whenever these properties are not satisfied, you know an error has occurred. So what are properties that these two bit strings have? If you notice, the first two bits and the last two bits always sum to zero. So the way you express that property is you put the bits in the circles and you connect any circles with a square if the bits in these circles sum to zero. Okay, now you can easily, and these squares are called checks because they check some property, and these circles are called bits. You can easily see that 000 and 111 satisfies these checks. You could either color it green or write a zero in the square. And if some sequence doesn't satisfy, I would put a one in the square. And the set of numbers on the squares is what I call a syndrome. It tells me something about the possible errors that could have occurred on my sequence. Okay. Now let's just recall the previous problem. We saw 001, which means the last two bits didn't sum to 1. So the syndrome is 01 in this case. And to correct the error, the question that you want to ask is, what is the binary sequence that you can put in these circles that satisfies this graph? And we know that the binary sequence should have least number of bits flipped because that's more probable. Now clearly it's 001 and 110, which has a lower probability of occurring. Okay, let's just be used to this formalism and take a slightly more complicated example. Now it's fast because you know that you received something and it didn't satisfy the second check, which ensures that the first and the fourth bits should sum to zero. Now you want to ask which is the binary sequence that you can put in the circles that satisfies this graph. Any quick guess? Yeah, that's right. So one and all zeros, which means that if you notice this syndrome, you should just go and flip the first bit in your sequence. Oh, you could say zero with two ones in the last, but that's the wrong choice, though it satisfies this syndrome because the probability of this error occurring is lesser. So, given a syndrome, you always want to look for the sequence that corresponds to the least number of bit flips. Okay, but in real world, examples are not so simple. You have a really complicated system of bits and checks, and you want to find that binary sequence that you can put in the circles that has the least number of bit flips and satisfies this graph. So we have a problem here where a naive method will take too long because there are too many errors with a given syndrome. Naive optimization is hard. You can't just take each one and find out which one has the minimum number of ones in it. So, and we don't know a polynomial time solution. But of course, if I tell you that this one satisfy, if I give a proposal for a solution, you can always verify it in polynomial time. Okay, so maybe this problem is NP complete. And indeed, it turns out that that is the case. It was shown by Meclis in 1978 that this problem of given a graph and a syndrome to determine the vector in the circles of the lowest weight for this syndrome is an NP complete problem. Okay, we know that we can make problems harder than NP, which is just instead of asking for a solution, just count the number of solutions. So the counting version of this problem is given a graph, a syndrome, and a number I, you want to find out how many sequences have I ones in it, that's of weight I, and satisfy this graph. This problem is known to be Sharpe complete. I don't recall when this was shown, but this is a proven result. So we have a problem that's NP complete and Sharpe complete. Let's see what these problems are in the quantum setting and whether they are harder or easier. Okay, just like bit strings, quantum information is encoded in qubit states that look like linear combination of these ket vectors. And any errors are nothing but operations on these states. So flipping a 1 to a 0 corresponds to an X type error that's given by this operator, the Pauli matrix X. And flipping the relative signs in these linear combinations is achieved by a Pauli Z matrix. And for now, let's just keep to only these two possibilities. And if you do so, you define a type of channel which is called an independent XZ channel. Okay. The setting is the same. Just like flipping classical bits, you would have a state that's transmitted and it undergoes some bit flips and some phase flips. And since these two are independent, you can assume that first it undergoes bit flips and then phase flips. So you can write the error as a product of M1 bit flips that happens first with M2 phase flips that happens after that. And the weight of an error is nothing but the total number of bit flips plus the total number of phase flips in this context. So, and just like we have a probability of a bit flip, we can assign probabilities to X type and Z type errors. And for simplicity, let's just take these two are equally probable. With this, you can multiply the probability on each wire to get the probability of an error that looks like this. And then you ask the question that a state is transmitted, it undergoes some error, and you receive phi. So if phi is received, what was transmitted? In other words, what's the error E? Okay, just like how you don't want to remember binary sequences, you also don't want to store these long superpositions of ket vectors. So you do a very same strategy as before. In the earlier case, properties were knowing which bits sum to zero, but in this case, properties of quantum states are nothing but measurement results. And in error correction, you don't want to measure something and destroy the state. So you want to measure something such that the measurement operator is an eigen, the state is an eigenvector of the measurement operators. So properties are nothing but a set of measurement operators that don't disturb the state, but can tell you something non-trivial about the state. Okay, so let's just take an example here. Here, you know that the state, all your encoded states have the property that they all are plus one eigenvectors of a set of three measurement operators. So anytime you observe a vector that's not an eigenstate, you will conclude that it's not a valid code word. Some error has occurred. Okay. In particular, since we have confined to only X and Z type errors, you know that if you start with an eigenstate, you will end up with an eigenstate, but it can have an eigenvalue plus or minus one. Okay. Now, if you know that a state has an eigenvalue minus one, then you know that the error that brought you to this state must have anti-commuted with the corresponding measurement operator. So instead of having a property on the states, you can have a property on the errors, which means if you measure these operators and find a result that's minus one, then you conclude that the unknown error has anti-commuted with the corresponding check. And if you get a result plus one, you know the error commutes with that check. So you have the same question here. So given a set of commutation and anti-commutation results with every generator, you want to find out the Pauli matrix that obeys these commutation and anti-commutation rules. How do you encode these commutation anti-commutation rules? You just say, I say 0 if it commutes and 1 if it anti-commutes. And this set of numbers is called a syndrome as before. So the question is, given a syndrome numbers on these squares, you want to know what Pauli matrix to put on these circles that satisfies this graph. Let's take the same syndrome as before. Okay, sorry. Codes that can be expressed by this sort of a compact notation are called stabilizer codes. And these measurement checks are called stabilizers. Okay, let's take the same syndrome as before. We know that some error has occurred in transmission, and this error commutes with the first check, which is x on the second and y on the third qubit, but it anti-commutes with the second check, which is z on the first qubit and y on the fourth, and it commutes with the third check. Anyone has a quick guess for what this Pauli matrix is? So whatever you put in these circles must commute with the operator on top of it if it's connected by a zero square, and it should anti-commute with the operator on top if it's connected by a one square. Yeah, that's perfect. So you can have x on the first one and then the all identities. This means that the first qubit is flipped during transmission. But because these operators on the squares that are checks are measurement operators, this error also flips just the first qubit, though it touches more than one qubit. It is because this error is nothing but flipping the first qubit and measuring one of the checks. So though this error has the least weight, this error has a greater weight, but it also does effectively the same thing as the previous one. So does this, and so does any error that's x all identities multiplied by any sequence of measurements. So you see that the probability of flipping just the first qubit is not just the probability of E, but it's the probability of E plus E dot S1 plus E dot S2 plus E dot any sequence of measurements. And since these errors effectively do the same thing on the encoded state, these errors are called equivalent or degenerate errors. And the probability of flipping the first qubit is just the sum of probabilities of all degenerate errors that flip the first qubit. So you notice the difference here, which is in the classical case, you could just probability of flipping the first bit is just probability is just the way it's you can find the probability of flipping the first bit by just identifying the precise vector that flips the first bit. But in this case, it doesn't suffice to just know that E flips the first qubit. You have to know all the operators in the that are equivalent to E to find out the probability of flipping the first qubit. And so the problem of interest here is that given a graph and a syndrome that's numbers on the squares, you want to find the degenerate class of errors that has the maximum probability. And this problem is what we call degenerate quantum maximum likelihood decoding. So let's just see what this means operationally. So you are given a graph and a syndrome. Suppose I write down all the errors that have this syndrome S. I just represent them as bars, as dashes, and the bars denote how probable they are. So what would a classical algorithm do? It knows that the error that occurred is the one with the highest probability. So it would just go and pick the highest bar here. Okay, but the quantum algorithm has to do more work in the sense that it knows that many errors in this set are equivalent to each other. So before you find out which one is the most probable one, you have to identify the equivalence classes of degenerate errors and then find which class has the maximum probability. Okay? So you see that in this case, E4 has the maximum sum, but it doesn't have the element that has the maximum probability. So classical decoding is different from the quantum decoding here. But of course, there can be some situations where you can have the maximum, the global maximum occurring in the set that has the maximum sum. And those cases are when the set that has the maximum sum is higher than all the others by a huge margin. So you know that the maximum here must contribute to E4, because if it did to any others, then you would see a significant rise in its probability. Okay, and the formal way of saying it is you say that delta is a gap between the highest and the second highest, and then you can say things like if delta is greater than some particular value, then classical decoding and quantum decoding do the same thing. Okay, so now we see that in a particular special case, you can use the classical algorithm to decode quantum stabilizer codes, but in the general case, you cannot. So we intuitively believe that in the general case, quantum decoding is harder than the classical case. And that's the main result of this talk. And the informal statement of the result is decoding a quantum stabilizer code is Sharpe complete. Technically, given a graph with n qubits, that's n circles, and n minus k checks, that's squares, doing this decoding problem with errors that can be only of x and z type, and with a gap that's fairly small, this problem is Sharpe complete. Now, if we just rewind back, I said that a problem is Sharpe complete if you can use it as a subroutine to do any Sharpe problem. So to formally claim or to prove this result, you have to show that you can use this. If a solution ever existed to DQMLD, you can use it as a subroutine to solve another Sharpe complete problem that's already known to be Sharpe complete. And we already saw an example of a Sharpe complete problem, which was in the classical case, given a graph and a syndrome and a number I, you want to count how many sequences have weight I and satisfy this graph. If you could use DQMLD to solve this problem, then you have formally proved that DQMLD is in fact Sharpie complete. Okay, now the rest of this talk, I will just outline how you could use this decoder oracle to compute the solution to the Sharpie complete problem, that's counting binary strings of a particular weight. Okay, let's go back to the class of degenerate errors. The class of degenerate errors look like a particular error multiplied with any sequence of measurements. So if you have three measurements, S1, S2, and S3, you can easily find that you can have 2^3 combinations of these measurements. So if there are m checks, you could have 2^m elements in a class of degenerate errors. So naively computing the probability for each error and summing all of them is not polynomial time. But you note that each probability, each error either flips, either does nothing, or it bit flips or phase flips 1 qubit or 2 qubits or all n qubits. So the probability of an error is either p0, p1 or anything, or p^i for some I between 0 and n. So though there are exponentially many elements in this set, many of them are in fact equal. So if you can group errors that have equal probabilities, you will end up with the probability of a class just being a polynomial in P. And each coefficient will now tell you how many errors have the corresponding probability. So now the probability of a class is in general a degree n polynomial with unknown coefficients. Now let's simplify this problem. Suppose there are just two classes of errors. So the probability of each class is a degree n polynomial with coefficients that are unknown. Now you want to ask if there is a solution if there is an efficient algorithm for the decoder, can you use it in polynomial time to extract these coefficients? Because if you could do so, you're already solving a problem for which brute force technique is ruled out, and there's no known polynomial time solution. In fact, it turns out that if there are just two classes, there is a polynomial time procedure to compute these coefficients a0 to an. At the moment, I won't go much into the details of this procedure, and I'll just complete the proof and then I'll come back to this. So the polynomial time process looks like this. I'm just representing it as this one. So it assumes that there are just two classes whose probabilities are 2° n polynomials, and it will interact with this black box algorithm for DQMLD, and in polynomial time it will extract the coefficients a0 to an. Now you might ask, extracting these coefficients was not the ultimate goal, because we don't know if finding these coefficients is a Sharpie complete problem. We only know that the Sharpie complete problem is, given a graph for a classical code, can you find how many sequences can be put in the circles of weight I? So the next step is to map the classical problem to a problem of computing these coefficients. And that's the second step in this proof, that is proving a theorem that says, given a graph for a classical code, there is a polynomial time process to construct a graph for a quantum code such that if ai is the number of bit strings satisfying that graph of weight I, ai will be the number of poly operators satisfying this graph of weight I. So now if you compute all the AIs for this particular graph, It amounts to computing all the AAs for that particular graph. So now we have two steps in our proof. And to get a method of computing all the AIs for the classical code, what we would do first is convert the problem to a quantum code with the same AIs and then extract out these coefficients. So doing so, you have used the DQMLD black box in polynomial time to compute all these coefficients. And computing those coefficients is a Sharpie complete problem, which means the DQMLD is also a Sharpie complete problem. Okay, the formal reduction statement is that given access to an oracle that solves DQMLD and with a gap between the highest probable logical class and the second highest, that's fairly small, that's n raised to minus lambda, you can compute lambda many coefficients of the weight enumerator. That's lambda many coefficients AI. Now, of course, lambda should be bigger than log n, because if lambda is anything less than log n, then you could do a brute force search. So if lambda is bigger than log n, then it's known that computing A lambda is Sharpie complete, which means DQMLD with this gap that's fairly small is Sharpie complete. Okay, so that completes the proof sketch of showing that DQMLD is Sharpie complete. Now I would like to just elaborate a little bit on step one and step two. So firstly, I want to show that I claim that you can, so you start with a classical code, and I claim that you could construct a quantum code out of this, such that if AI is the number of bit strings of weight I satisfying that, AI will be the number of bit strings of weight I satisfying this as well. So I just want to elaborate on how you could do so. A classical code, a classical binary linear code is specified by a generating matrix. And suppose the rows of the generating matrix are G1 to GK. What you could do is find the rows of the generating matrix for the dual code and add it to G1 to GK. So you would get something that spans all possible binary strings. That's Z2n. Since this matrix is full rank, it will have an inverse, and just call the inverse, just let the inverse have rows H1 to HK. Okay. Now you're given the inputs G1 to GK. What you would do is each row is a binary string. So if you find a 1, you replace it with a Z, and if you find a 0, you replace it with the identity. So I write this as Z raised to G1 until Z raised to GK. Now, these all commute. So technically, they are generators of a stabilizer group. But we have an additional condition that this stabilizer code must have only two classes of errors. Now we have to do a bit more work to ensure that there are just two classes of errors. What we would do is add more generators to this group such that the number of logical operators reduce. So one way is for every row from GK plus 1 to GN, you add another qubit initialized in the Z state, the plus 1 eigenstate of Z. And now you can add n minus k more generators. And in the end, what you would end up with is a stabilizer code that encodes one logical qubit and has these two logical operators. Now still there are, since there are two logical generators, there are four possible classes of errors. Now to rule out two possible classes of errors, one needs to note that two possible classes of errors will involve non-trivial actions on the added qubits. So if you can somehow ensure that the added qubits are error-free, you can you can be sure that the class that the there are only two possible classes of errors that are possible. Okay. Now what you do is you add another qubit to the code, and you assume that this qubit is not affected by an independent XZ channel, which means the probabilities of X errors and Z errors can be asymmetric on this qubit. If you do that, then what you would find is the probability of the identity class as before is the polynomial in P, and so is the probability of the other class. So you have two classes, as we claimed, whose probabilities are n degree and polynomials in P. So that completes the conversion from a classical code to a quantum stabilizer code. The next claim was, if you have a quantum stabilizer code whose such that only two error classes are possible and they are in degree and polynomials, then how do you extract these coefficients? Now this is an interesting problem by itself. Note that this decoder, that's DQMLD, will only tell you which polynomial evaluates to a higher value. It will not reveal the value of the polynomial. So just by using this polynomially many times, you have to find the coefficients. So in other words, if these two polynomials say look like this between 0 to half in P, then suppose you input P1 to the decoder, it will just tell you E1 because E1 evaluates to a higher value, but it will not reveal what is the corresponding value on the y-axis. But so if you say if you input P2, it will output E2. But since the output at P1 and P2 are different, you know that there is some point between P1 and P2 where these two probabilities cross. At this point, the two polynomials must be the same. So you use this property and say that at this point, I have a linear constraint between these two polynomials. And since, sorry, I have a linear constraint between the coefficients of these two polynomials. And by if I have many linear constraints, then I can solve them simultaneously and fix the value of these coefficients. That's the basic idea here. Of course, this if you assume that now I'm assuming that I should know P star really accurately. I should know really precisely where these two cross. Suppose I don't know this precisely. Suppose the decoder is not so powerful enough to exactly tell me which point the output switches. I would have a relaxed constraint. That's not an equality constraint, but it's an inequality constraint. Anyway, we needn't worry much about the relaxed case here. So if I have, since I have 2n plus 2 unknown coefficients, if I have 2n plus 2 constraints, I can put them together and solve the system of equations to find out the values of these coefficients. Now, in the relaxed case, these are inequality constraints, but with some work, it turns out that you can assume them to be equalities as long as delta is upper bounded by this particular function. And in fact, it turns out that these conditions are linearly independent. So solving them will finally give you the values of these coefficients. You don't really want the values of B0 to Bn. You only want the values, you only want the first n plus 1 values, which count how many bit strings of a given weight in a classical code. Okay. So by doing that, you have shown that if you can solve DQMLD, you can solve a Sharpe complete problem. In other words, DQMLD is also Sharpe complete. So just to wrap up, we saw how to say a problem is hard or easy. In fact, We saw the mention of the fact that decoding classical codes is hard. It was shown in 1978 by these people that decoding classical codes is an NP-complete problem. It was known in 2011 that decoding a quantum stabilizer code is at least as hard as decoding a classical code, which means it's also NP-complete. But clearly, we see that it's in fact much harder than decoding a classical code. That's what we have shown. We have shown that decoding a quantum stabilizer code is a Sharpe complete problem. And with that, I would like to end. Thank you.
All right, so if there are no clear questions for Pavitran, then I guess let's thank him again.